Tonight, I'd like to speak for a little bit and then open it up for questions and dialogue. And I want to speak about three phrases: turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening and savoring. When I was spoke last here, I know a year or so ago, I think I spoke about these a little bit, but tonight I'd like to go into them more deeply and draw them into a larger topic, which is deep listening and befriending the mind. We can't hear deeply in others things that we can't hear in ourselves. So these three phrases outline a strategy for listening deeply in many of life's situations. They're helpful in light-spirited moments, and they're also particularly valuable in difficult times, you know, when we're feeling discouraged or hurt or sad or lonely or stressed. This past year, our collective situation has been more dire than any time I can remember. Pandemic, racial inequalities, writ large, economic breakdown, climate change, sociopathic president, degradation of political discourse, all those fires we had in the fall, and on and on on. There are great opportunities in difficult times. You can sometimes shift things more quickly when things are stirred up, but I mean that's true, but they are difficult, and first thing we need are ways to be with our individual and collective angst. So this evening, I want to focus on deep listening to ourselves so that we're better able to listen to the world around us and those people around us. And the strategy that I want to explore is summarized by these three phrases: turning towards whatever life brings us, internally or externally, inside us or outside us, just turning towards it. Relaxing into any tension that we find inside. And then deepening or looking beneath the surface to the subtle underlying roots of our experience. What's underneath is oftentimes different than how it manifests up on the surface. So this deepening process is really important. And when the process goes deep enough, it turns into savoring. So my shorthand for all of this is turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening or savoring. These practices are really about how we relate to ourselves. And I'm not suggesting that self is something that we are, or even something that we own. I'm proposing that our self is really, it's really like a traveling companion. Who and what we really are is completely mysterious, but we have this itinerant chum that we hang out with and call me. We don't have full control over our thoughts or our feelings or the self that moseys along with us. So, for example, don't think about a blue panda. There a blue panda in your mind? Did you put it there? I don't think so. I put it there just by uttering those words, blue panda. Can you push it out of your mind? Good luck with that. So we have influence over our thoughts and feelings and these moods that waltz through us, but we don't have full control. And if we can't control them, then surely they're not us. They're just a traveling companion. So in trying to decide on a subtitle, one of them that I like a lot is befriending the heart mind, the mind heart. So I'm suggesting that this sense of self arises out of our biological wiring, modified by our history. And we can enrich our lives by cultivating a clear and kind relationship to the sense of self that travels along with us. But before I make all this sound too esoteric, it really is not esoteric at all. But to show that, it might be helpful for me to give an example of how we can deepen our relationship to the self through these practices of turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening or saving. Every year, I lead a 9-day retreat. And during that retreat, I like to meet with each of the meditators, each of the yogis, individually, every day, so that we can together can fine-tune their practice. There's only enough time in a day to meet individually with about 18 or 20 yogis, so the retreats have filled up quickly. Several years ago, I invited another teacher to co-lead with me. Tonight, I'll just refer to her as Jill. Together, we could accept twice as many people. Then, several months before the retreat, when we were almost filled to capacity, Jill had an epiphany. She had this big insight. Her epiphany was that she couldn't co-lead the retreat with me. She said she didn't want to have a long conversation about it, but she wanted me to understand her thoughts, and she wrote me a long email. The essence of her concern was that she didn't think I was tough enough. Retreats provide a rare opportunity for people to go deeper. And she felt that it was important for yogis to work hard. My experience has been that for every yogi who doesn't put enough effort into the practice, there are about 20 who put too much effort into it. Over-efforting can make the body and the psyche stiffen up. But if people would just relax, let go of the mind's stories, there's a natural peacefulness that can emerge. She, on the other hand, thought that my easy and awake style of teaching would lead to a mellow mush, not the clarity and precision of the Buddha's meditation. And furthermore, she thought that our divergent styles would be confusing and discouraging for yogis. And she said discouraging yogis, discouraging people, to her was a mortal sin. That was just her tongue-in-cheek way of saying she felt very strongly about it. Well, since she didn't want to discuss it with me, I just sent her a short note. I said I was disappointed that it wasn't going to work out, but that I understood that if she felt that working with me violated some of her integrity, I got it that she had to withdraw, and I wished her well. Doesn't that sound mature of me? I thought it sounded mature. I felt clear and it felt accurate, and I thought it would bring closure for me. Well, it didn't bring closure. The next time I sat down to meditate, my mind just rumbled incessantly. We have more people coming than I can manage alone. Our divergent styles would be enriching. The Buddha himself taught different people different ways. Grumble, rumble, grumble, grumble, grumble. I was angrier than I realized. So I ignored the content of the rumbling, and I turned towards and relaxed into the anger itself. It's the energetic feel of the anger. Just relax right into its very center. And of course, when I did that, it intensified. So I kept turning towards the resentment, relaxing into it, radiating kindness out into the world, only to have my mind go back into another outburst. Now, I believe, and have come to believe, and I'm quite confident that just from years of practice, that if awareness gets to the subtle conditions underneath, then this tension would release. Yet after a number of days, my mind was still nitpicking furiously. I was stuck. There must be something I'm missing, I thought. So I opened up more deeply. And as I went more deeply into my feelings, I began to feel hurt. And deepening into the center of that hurt, there was a soft tenderness. And in the center of that tenderness was loneliness. I felt unseen. And it seemed ancient and just intolerable. But it was clearly there, this deep and familiar sense of abandonment. So I relaxed into the core of that loneliness. Deep listening, relaxing into the core of it. About a week had gone by now. And I was still turning towards and relaxing into it, yet this rumbling and nitpicking persisted and morphed into this loneliness. So I let go of the label loneliness and just sunk into the felt sense of my experience. It was as if I was a piece of bamboo, you know, hard on the outside, but hollow and dark and dusty in the middle. So I let down into that hollowness. And as I did, there was this little thought that trickled up. Maybe Jill is right. Maybe my practice is mellow mush. Maybe my teaching and practicing are really all wrong. Maybe they're just all wrong. The way my body responded to this may be a little surprising. This chuckle rose up from inside me. I found myself smiling uncontrollably. This was the root condition of the root conditions of the root of this whole episode. I doubted my practice. Worry and doubt come very easily to me, even when they hide in the shadows. My body chuckled more as it resonated with the truth of this. It was such a relief to expose the doubt that was at the core of my disturbance. And instantly, I knew exactly what to do with it. I didn't even have to think about it. It was obvious. I would conduct some empirical trials. I would practice a little harder and notice the effect. And then I'd practice a little softer and notice the effect. I didn't require anybody, any friend, colleague, teacher, anyone, to tell me if my practice was optimal. Frankly, I didn't even care about my own opinions. I just experiment and find out directly in my own experience. And suddenly, I didn't care what Jill or anyone else thought. I had doubt about my practice and a sure way to address it. I almost laughed out loud. And I was so grateful to Jill for stimulating this inner environment that helped me find this clarity and helped it to surface. And as I went into my next meditation, body and mind became very deep and very peaceful as everything faded but awareness itself. And a deep calm enveloped me. So do you see how this works? Turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening or savoring. Superficially, this little story, this example is about meditation. I spend a lot of time in meditation these days, or mentoring meditators. But turning towards relaxing into and deepening are simple and subtle and universal enough to be effective, whether you meditate for 5 hours a day or 30 minutes a week when you come to SBMG on Sunday evenings. So I'd like to unpack these three practices and then reflect on how to use them in all kinds of situations. And as I do this, I'll share a little bit about how they appear in the text, give a little bit of background of where these practices come from. Most scholars and students of Buddhism agree that the four truths are really at the core of the Buddha's teaching. But these aren't capital T truths. Rather, they are simple meditation instructions. And they're all based on very practical, simple observations. I like to refer to the first three of these as the three essential practices. In the Buddhist text, the first truth, or the first essential practice, is literally translated as there is suffering, and suffering is to be understood. Notice it doesn't say life is suffering. That gets put on Buddhism sometime, but Buddhism is not that pessimistic. It just says life has suffering. Is that news to any of you? Is there anyone here who has never suffered, never felt hurt or sad or lonely or angry or discouraged? I don't think so. I don't think so. So it's really a simple and quite obvious observation. There is suffering. What's important is not the observation, but what to do with it. Suffering is to be understood. And the Buddha went on to say, and suffering has been understood by me, meaning that part of how he got to where he got to was from understanding suffering. And we can do the same. So here, this is tr the word is translated into English as understand, but it doesn't refer to an intellectual analysis, but it refers to a direct, intuitive knowing, deep listening. For example, if we understand a friend, we know what lifts her up. We know what brings her down, how she views life, what she yearns for, and so on. We're not going to understand suffering if we're busy trying to fix it, or rise above it, or push it aside, or distract ourselves from it, any more than we could understand a friend if we were doing that. To understand a person, or a process, or ourselves, we must first turn towards and open up to what we're experiencing and open up to it in its own terms. Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, he once wrote, "Imagine an awareness that sees to the very heart of suffering with no urge to change anything." Sees to the heart of suffering with no urge to change anything. And imagine that that awareness is the opposite of indifference. That's what we're talking about. When we observe our pain, our suffering, and angst openly, we see that one thing that all forms of suffering have in common, one element they all have in common, is tension. Tanha is the Buddhist word here, tension or tightness. Without tension or resistance of some kind, we may experience strong sensations, but we don't actually suffer unless there's something fighting back against it. So the second truth, or the second essential practice, is literally translated with a very dramatic verb. I'm not a great Pali scholar, but when I'm reading the text, what I like to do is get three or four or five scholars who I trust and put their translations side by side, because many will translate these words differently. But all of them translate this one word the same. So in the text, it says there is tension, and tension is to be abandon. It's a very dramatic term. How do we abandon tension? How do you abandon tension? You relax. The tension might be physical, it might be emotional or mental. It doesn't really matter. We simply invite it to soften and relax. You know, in English, the verb relax, it has some aversive connotations to it. Relax, man, let it go, push it away. Aversion is the opposite of turning towards. So I like to translate the second practice as relax into. We relax any tension, but not as a way to distance ourselves from it, but as a way to open more deeply into the experience. We relax into our angst, into our anger, our fear, our yearning, our grief. Like I did with my reaction to Jill when she pulled out. This allows us to see more deeply into the experience of hurt or grief or stress and understand them, know them better. The third noble truth, or the third essential practice, takes all this a step further. The language in the text is, Nirodha is to be realized. Nirodha has a technical meaning, but the essence of Nirodha is a deep sense of peace and well-being. And realize simply means to make it real. So to let it be real, it's not enough just to superficially see what's going on. We need to see into the core. We need to see deeply what's going on underneath our experience. So, for example, if we turn towards and relax into our fear, our hurt, our heartache, we see that underneath that aching, there's tenderness, right? If we aren't tender, if we're just emotional brick, then we wouldn't actually suffer. So anytime we feel any kind of distress, there is some tenderness underneath that. And if we relax into this tenderness, there is some openness or spaciousness. Without any openness, there would be no tenderness. And if we relax deeply into this openness, we may experience freedom, get a taste of freedom. Well, of course, we all want that sense of freedom and inner peace and spiritual aliveness and openness of being. But, you know, too often we look for it by turning away from our difficulty, hardening against hurt, distracting ourselves. But it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Not in the long run. To find the deepest well-being, we have to turn towards, relax into, and deepen through our experience of difficulty. The only path that works over time goes through the suffering and tenderness into that little bit of openness, rather than try to do an end run around it. So rather than fix, transcend, rise above, or push our difficulties aside, we can turn towards, relax into, and deepen. And when we go deep enough, the deepening turns into savoring. And we let that well-being soak into our bones, like I did with Jill. In fact, when we turn towards and relax into, sometimes a sense of well-being just comes up right away. And if so, We just savor it and let it soak into our being, soak into our bones. But if what comes up is uncomfortable, we turn towards, relax into, and deepen until we experience the tenderness and openness beneath. Imagine an awareness that sees into the heart of suffering with no urge of changing anything. And imagine that awareness is the opposite of indifference. I think part of the reason the Buddha included this is that we are actually more sensitive to pain and difficulty than we are to well-being. Neuroscientists say that we are about 4 times more sensitive to pain than well-being. And I think it's an evolutionary thing. Because pain and distress and fear, they are all warning signals. There's something that needs to be dealt with. So if we ignore those signals because we're just looking for pleasure, then we get into trouble. So it's been bred into us, but it's very easy to go overboard. So the Buddha suggests that when we experience even a little uplift, if it's genuine, it really helps. It helps in the practice and helps in our life to realize that well-being is there and deepen into it and savor it. So I'd like to open it up to questions and comments and remarks, and I'll respond to anything you ask me. Whether I can answer your question or not, that's a different story, but I will respond. But before we do that, would you like to just try these practices out for a few moments, just take them out for a test run? If so, just take a moment now and think of some situation that's uncomfortable for you. It might be a big thing or it might be a small thing. It's okay. Could be about a relationship or emotions or your feeling about the world or the pandemic or some sense of failure or letdown. Could be anything that pulls your spirits down. So I invite you, we'll just spend a few moments with us to close your eyes and bring to heart some of the suffering in your life. And just open up to it. Don't try to think or analyze it. Those can be helpful in some situations, but our thoughts are also quite gullible. So instead, just feel your way into the situation by simply turning towards it in your mind and with your heart, and open up to it and just let it be as it is. And whatever feelings come up, simply notice if there's any tension in them. Don't try to change the situation or what you feel. Just notice if there's any tightness or tension or thickness in the mind or heart. And gently invite it to soften. Don't need to force it. It's just an invitation. See if you can relax into the tension. And as you do that, notice if there's any tenderness underneath. And if so, just relax into that tenderness. And notice any openness or spaciousness beneath the tenderness. And if you see even a taste, Just see if you can relax into that. And let that spaciousness soak into your bones, soak into your being. Just gently savor it. Just savor it. It's not to push anything else aside, but just to open up to it and savor it. May it be so. Namaste.
Has questions, if you want to raise your hand, either in video or in the participant link, and if I see you, I'll call on you, and then just go ahead and unmute yourself and ask questions. Okay, I see Carson has a question. Go ahead.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for your talk.
Hi, Carson.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
See? I was just curious if you could tell us a little bit about you, your understanding of tanha as tension. I think I think I get it, but I would like to hear a little bit more about that. Just I'm used to the... more familiar with it being translated as craving or thirst, you know, something like that. And the connection between the two. And then I like the tie-in with Heidegger's, the line, although I keep both times you said it, I kept thinking, are you sure we're not supposed to have an urge to change something?
Thank you for asking that. That's a great question. Both of those. Let me start with Heidegger, okay. And then we'll come back to the tanha. What happens with a lot of people that if they can't tolerate the discomfort, is then they want to fix other people so that they themselves won't be uncomfortable. So if our hearts are open, you know, of course, you know, if somebody is suffering, we would like them to feel better. But our love is not contingent upon them doing anything. You know, I work as a psychotherapist as well as a meditation teacher. So I spend a lot of, you know, time helping people sort stuff out. But I'm really not good to them. I found that years ago when I started, if I can't see the goodness and the light in the heart in them, something that doesn't need to be changed, if I can't experience that, then I'm probably not going to be much good to them. And I'm just sort of manipulating them. And I spent a number of years working with street kids, you know, really tough kids. And it was just as important with them. I had to see, you know, sometimes just the glimmer in their eye or something, so I knew that was real. And then I could talk to that part of them. So that's the most important part. So when the heart is open and sees suffering, it just flows out to it. That's the Buddhist definition of compassion. So thanks for asking about that. Tanha, yeah, it's tricky with the text. Part of it is that the translations, oftentimes, and I think it was, you know, after the Buddha died and the couple generations after that, there was huge competition. There were sanghas all over the place, different teachers and stuff, a lot of competition. And so a lot of the translations were actually made reaching out to try to convince people to come and make the Buddha their guy. So that's one piece of it. And another piece of it is that the first translations of Pali into English were done by the Jesuits. You know, Jesuits are far out dudes, you know, that's really out there. But all they had was King James English. So a lot of the translations are really in the extreme. So tanha does refer to craving. It does refer to, you know, feeling like a mad dog, you know. It also refers to ennui. It also refers to that subtle sense of, oh, you know, it really is that whole wide range. And what they all have in common underneath them is tension. And part of the reason that I like to point that out is for our meditation practices. It's really, really, really helpful. You know, you don't have to get rid of craving. All you have to do is see the tension in it, because the tension is the fuel that drives it. And you can let the whole complex be what it is, but allow the tension to drain out of it, and the whole thing will drain. Too often people try to get rid of their craving. Well, that's just a version for an attraction. So you add that intention to tension. But seeing clearly and openly and heartfully how something operates, arises and passes, etc., is a very, very wholesome quality. And so if you can see the tension there with that clarity, it just won't be able to hang on for long. I mean, the simple example of that is if you make a fist and hold it really tight, you know, gradually it starts hurting, you know. But if you pay attention to it, at some point it just releases. If you're not aware of it, you stick it behind your back, you can probably keep it tight for a long time. But if you're aware of it, there's this natural release that just happens.
Great. That's really helpful. That's a good move. Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Doug.
Along those lines, can you speak about that word Nirodha again? I always had it also in a little different translation.
Yeah. So Nirodha, it technically feels, it refers to cessation, perception, consciousness, and feeling. That what happens as the mind heart, as the awareness relaxes more and more and more, you can see that even remember something takes a little bit of tension to kind of push it into memory. And to even perceive something, you know, as put a label on it, takes just a little bit of tension. And so what happens is as the mind and heart get more deeply relaxed, then perception and memory actually fade. And so the subjective experience of that is that you're meditating, and then you see that it's a little blank spot. Sometimes it feels like you're nodded off, right? But you look, you know, if you're not off, then when you come back, you know, the mind is usually sluggish. But there can be those times where those little blank spots when you come back, and actually the mind is clear. So that is technically what Nirodha is that those moments of cessation. And when it goes deeply enough, then when you come back, the mind is just luminous. And that's Nibbana. So they have those technical definitions, but, you know, for the wider practice, is that they, you know, Nirodha is the sort of ultimate form of equanimity. It's this deep, peaceful, open place that's so equanimous that even perception shuts down for a little bit. And so, you know, in light of the third ennobling truth, a Naroda is to be realized. It's just letting in those uplifted qualities when they come.
And may I ask also, just to follow up, that is what you're speaking of on the cushion, mm-hmm. or do these experiences perhaps influence off the cushion a deepening awareness in the moment and a relaxation into, and maybe even cessation or?
Yeah. Okay. So. Yes, yeah. So I'm actually being very loose with the term. So I gave you the technical definition of it, but yeah, I'm actually using it in a much, much broader sense. Because technically, you probably couldn't go into Naroda when you're up walking around, because you need some consciousness to keep it together. But certainly there can be incredibly deep, peaceful states that come out. I mean, I live near the American River, and I just love to walk out there in the woods. And particularly if I'm all stirred up about something, I'm walking out there, you know, and I'm looking around, and there are all these trees, and the trees actually don't care whether I feel good or not, you know? And I look at them, and suddenly I don't care whether I feel good or not. And then I may have all, you know, all these thoughts and things I'm worried about, but they just don't matter anymore. They just sort of dissipate. So that is actually approaching the high in there, and approaching that Naroda. But technically, you cannot be in Naroda, and still, you need some awareness to move your feet and keep from falling over. So I was playing.
That was wonderful. I love the trees. Thank you.
No, yeah, you could do it. You know, it's like, you know, I'm feeling miserable about it. I'm locked up here, and I'm blah 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 blah. And, you know, and the trees are just fine with me being who I am.
Yeah, and then the next thing you know, there's a salmon jumping, or there's a deer. Yeah. Woohoo! Yeah. Who cares? Thank you. That was really very helpful.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Andy, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Andy.
I appreciate your story quite a bit. I really like that. What about the idea of relaxing into the sense, kind of love and care that someone might experience of not wanting to go there? So when I hear you're speaking, I'm getting the sense that there's something that's painful. The idea is to relax into it. Mm-hmm. But paradoxically, I can imagine, and I've definitely had that experience where people are, I just can't go there. And if the idea is to go there, then there's like that re-triggering of shame, I'm not doing it right. So it seems like a sweet intermediate, but I want to see how that fits, at least in your mind, just opening the for the possibility of people that are just really too scared to relax into something that's difficult.
Yeah, and it's really helpful to know yourself, and if something is re-traumatizing, you know, etc. But you can also, so what you don't want to do is you don't want to force it. It really is a relaxing into. And so if there's a place that just wants to go there, just doesn't want to go there, can you relax into the tension that doesn't want to go there, you know, and just open up that and honor that, rather than get a big stick and say, you know, you got to be kinder, you know.
Right.
You know, so compassion, you know, technically in Buddhism described as the outflowing of the heart in response to seeing suffering in another, or seeing our own suffering. And so when we come up against that suffering, you know, in ourselves, it's really important to bring a lot of that heart opening to it, and trust, if you can, or experiment, if you don't actually trust, of just opening up to how it is, including being open to being closed.
Yeah.
that, I really have come to believe in kind of a reverse paranoia, you know, that the universe is really out to get us enlightened. And so we don't have to fight against it. We don't have to push. And what happens in our practice and in therapy and meditation and anything else, you know, eventually, you know, we get to a point where something tightens up and we fight and say, okay, well, this is different. Yeah, I really believe in love and openness and kindness, but not here. This is different. So, no, none of them are different. You bring love and kindness to that fear and that difficulty. And that will, with patience, it will open it up. Somebody said once, with patience, nothing is impossible. I also like the old prayer, God, give me patience, and I want it right now. But that's another story. So patience, presence. You know, it's, I think of it as what happens. What are your instincts when your child wakes up in the middle of the night with a nightmare? I mean, you don't talk them through it or try to talk them out of it. You just kind of sit with them. You just trying to be with them. So we want to befriend the mind, heart, find that way of being with it, not try to force it, but just be with it. And then with my reverse paranoia, what I'm really convinced is that will, in the long run, that will open us up and take us as far as we can go.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yvonne, go ahead.
Hi, Del.
Hi, Yvonne.
Thank you for the talk. I've been having a few hard days emotionally. Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned to relax, you know, was the opposite of the tension. And I've been feeling tense emotionally and physically. Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned it, I got like my aha moment that, oh my God, I forgot to take care of myself. I didn't go for a walk. I didn't take a hot shower. I didn't walk or, you know, get out of my room. I just wanted to be in my bed and cry.
Yeah.
And it didn't help. I was enjoying myself. I guess I was.
Oh, but you bring your heart into bed when you cry with, you know, to just.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, we forgot to take care of ourselves, or we got involved into the drama so hard that we forgot to do something else. I just noticed I forgot for 2-3 days now to do something for me. To change. And you know, when you do physically something, sorry, English is not my first language, but when you do something physically, your body releases hormones and your body releases substances that will help. And I didn't do any of that. And I know a little bit of yoga, and I know I just wanted to be suffering. I just, I guess, in some way to not to do anything. And it just made me realize that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And part of it is realizing that your heart's really in the right place. You know, and sometimes we push ourselves. And if you actually soften through all that, there's some caring. You know, there's some caring underneath that pushes too hard, mm-hmm. right? You didn't care about anything, then you just pull out. So it's helpful to see that the caring is actually underneath it. And and what's missing and what you're talking about was there's not the wisdom at the point to see that actually there are more skillful ways, you know, to be caring, including starting with yourself.
Yeah, I was, I don't know, that the heart, it was heavy. It was just really heavy.
Yeah. And you bring the heaviness, you know, into the heart, you know, and just like, you know, the heart can handle anything. I mean, really.
Yeah. Just the mind is the hard part.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just imagining that what you're saying, everybody can identify with, you know. Well, push yourself too hard.
Thank you.
Helen, you have something?
So, Doug, your you're talking about a very conscious life. Mm-hmm. A really conscious approach to whatever you meet. And I notice in my ups and downs that maybe a bit like Yvonne, sometimes I just have to hide under the covers, whether it's whatever form that takes, with some faith in the mm-hmm. Dharma.
Yes. Or
what I learned from Quakers, this thing mm-hmm. that goes on inside of us, I don't think it shows up in Buddhism, but this process called seasoning, that stuff mm-hmm. sits in us and we try to care for ourselves, and we may or may not be skillful, and we may or may not attend to ourselves very closely because it's just too hard. But there's also an element of faith and patience, because at least at my advanced age, I've noticed things actually do change and they do get better. I can't yeah. deny it anymore. Nothing is going to be the end of the world like I thought it was. So do you have anything to say about that thing of just kind of like checking out with faith?
Yeah. Do it consciously, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to check out for a while. So you're not fooling yourself, and then go ahead and check out. You know, it's really okay. I sit for a couple hours first thing in the morning, and what I began to realize was that when I sit down to meditate, I can be real diligent about my practice. You know, a thing called the 6 hours, recognizing, releasing, relaxing, do all that stuff, and my mind will be jumping along, and so I work really hard on it. In about 45 minutes, my mind will go into a peaceful place. Okay. And other days I can go in there and do nothing and just let the mind run around like, you know, a drunken banshee, and it will just go crazy for about 10 minutes. And then it just drops into this deep stillness. And so I realized, you know, I can work really, really hard on this and things will quiet down in 3/4 of an hour, or I can just relax and it'll drop all by itself in about 10 minutes. Now, what's more skillful here? So part of it is recognizing, and part of the wisdom we build is just how our system, you know, has been conditioned. And so mine is, you know, I have a little bit of German blood, you know, and so I tend to push hard. So there's this balance between, you know, relaxation and discipline, not in the strict sense, but in the sense of clarity, you know? Mm-hmm. And what helps is to allow ourselves to fall off each side of the road equal number of times, you know? And if you're like me, if you push a little hard, mm-hmm. then bringing things back into balance looks like laziness.
Yeah.
Because from that point, it's moving towards that letting go. Well, give it some time and just try it out, these empirical trials, and see what works. And I think when we do those, it's really helpful to do both sides of it. Uh-huh. So we begin to figure out where the middle path really is, because the middle path may be way off on an extreme side of what we're familiar with. But just play with it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
just experiment with it.
For me, it's an either rebellion or an act of freedom not to work on it, because I'm conditioned to like get with this, or like your German background, whatever. And so there's a way that if I surrender to my feeling miserable, or with some I know for me, I'm using this word faith because it's built up over the decades.
Confidence.
Yeah, trust.
Sada.
I call it trust in the Dharma. And then, yeah, what you said, like in 10 minutes, something loosens up.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I don't see that in the Buddhist literature because we're supposed to be waking up all the time. But there's a way that for my conditioning, to be off duty is pretty radical. Yeah.
So when I was practicing in Thailand, you know, my teacher was saying, you got to push hard. You got to, you know, work. And I say, you know, my teacher say I work too hard. He says, no, you can't work too hard. You got to, you know, really push. So I go back. I mean, I've gone all the way around the world, you know. So I follow these teachings and see what happens. And so I went in, I practiced real hard, and I come back in, and I start describing to him in my next interview what I was doing. And his eyes get bigger and bigger and bigger. And he said, go out and buy some ice cream. And I got it. That, you know, a lot of these practices have come through Southeast Asia. And if you've ever been, you know, in Thailand or some of those places, those are the mellowest people in the whole world. Uh-huh. You know, very sweet and kind. They need to tighten up a little bit. Yeah. Us Westerners, we get hemorrhoids in our sleep, you know. So we really need laxative. And so I realized, you know, he was talking to Thai people, not to me. And so I just started running the instructions through that understanding.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sure. And then when you're not sure about it, again, empirical trials, just try going easy on it. Try going hard on it. And just see for yourself, you know, where it is. Because the balance point, I mean, you've been practicing for a long time, Helen. So there's just a lot of momentum built up there. And so just to kind of relax and go with it and see what happens. You know, and I will do that and I relax and things will open up and relax and things will open up and then I relax and it just falls apart. And so I begin to get a little more skill at noticing when it's going to go out of whack and when it's really, really helpful. It's like trying to find where that balance place is. And just knowing that if you are completely in balance, you'd be enlightened. So if you're not, then there's some place that needs some balancing and you just check out where it is.
It's a wonderful place to end. Doug, would you like to close with dedication or if you would like, we can do that.
Yeah. So I invite you to just take a moment, you know, to settle in. We have all known peacefulness. We've all experienced kindness. We all know love. We've all felt generosity. They may not be with you at this moment, but we all know what they feel like. So just let yourself just invoke that, any of those Brahma Viharas, any of those uplifted qualities. And then just imagine breathing those out to the world. What happens with them is not any of your business. Our business is to send those out. May all beings know peacefulness. May all beings know kindness. May all beings know joy. May all beings have sweet dreams. May it be so. Blessed be. Namaste.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Welcome.
Thank you to everyone.